Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
For all the deference paid to King Henry VIII or Queens Mary or Elizabeth I, all the power they wielded and all the jewels and palaces they owned, day-to-day life for the average middle-class American in the 21st century is arguably more comfortable. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. For all their riches, the Tudors had to live without central heat and air, stick deodorant, Tylenol, spandex, DVRs, and memory foam. But they endured, as did their far less privileged subjects, whose lives turn out to have been cleaner and more interesting than we might imagine. Ruth Goodman is a historian of British social and domestic life who hosted the BBC series Tudor and Monastery Farm and was historical advisor to the miniseries Wolf Hall. Her new book is called How to Be a Tudor, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Tudor Life. Ruth, welcome back to Think.
Hello, welcome. Thank you.
If you would be so kind to remind your American audience, who were the Tudors and to what extent would the rest of England have taken its cues from how the royals lived?
Well, they were our kings and queens. Henry Tudor was the first and he took the throne by battle. Pure and simple. Yeah, he did sort of have a bit of a blood relationship, but it came down to the sword. His son, Henry VIII, followed him to the throne. And then there was a bit of a hiatus because Henry famously had trouble with wives and the producing of sons. His son did, in fact, take the throne for a few short years, but died very young. And then it moved to his eldest daughter, Mary. She too had health issues and was gone before very long. But his second daughter, Elizabeth, enjoyed a very long reign. She too, of course, failed to produce an heir, and that brought the end of the House of Tudor.
I live in a house that is old by American standards, and I was thinking about the Tudors and their wardrobes. You know, the one original closet left in my house is very small by modern standards because people 100 years ago did not have a lot of clothes. 5 centuries ago, they might have had just a couple of garments to last years.
Yeah, it's hard to get your head around, isn't it? Just how precious textiles were, how few they were,
yeah. And
how people had to make them last. I mean, people certainly didn't hang anything in wardrobes. There were no wardrobes as such. If you had something spare, you put it in a chest where you could lock it up nice and safe, thank you very much. But very few people had much to lock up. Most people had, in essence, what they were stood up in, plus one spare set, which they might use for Sunday best. That was really it. Only the sort of quite wealthy end of the middle class had much more than that. And even Elizabeth herself, or Henry himself, if you look at their wardrobe accounts, these clothes are utterly gorgeous, and yet they're being very frugal with their use. They tend to sort of like, if it's looking a bit tired, they don't throw it away. They take it apart, carefully clean each part, put it together back together again in a different format so that it looks like something new. They're forever recycling the clothes that they have.
And because that's partially because if you decided you wanted or needed something new, it was like, okay, step one, let's go buy some sheep and raise them to maturity.
Well, I mean, you didn't have to go and buy the sheep. You could buy the finished cloth. But the whole process of manufacture was way more labour intensive and much less productive than modern. So, I mean, you even just start with the sheep, since you mentioned sheep. I mean, modern sheep are, well, we all know how big a modern sheep is. And most of them have twins every time that they give birth. Indeed, many modern sheep have triplets these days. But a Tudor sheep was really much smaller, much smaller. And it always pretty much had a single lamb. So even at that stage, your productivity has fallen, isn't it? From twins down to a single lamb and a much smaller body on the beast. And the fleeces that came off them were different too. Nowadays, sheep have supplementary feeding. You know, there's all sorts of various farming specialist products that produce good wool production for the beast right through the year. But a Tudor sheep pretty much had to scavenge what it could get. So its wool tended to be finer, so that makes a very fine cloth. But there wasn't so much of it. So again, productivity is sort of, and that's before you even start with manufacturing. And everything had to be done by hand. They had to be sheared by hand with a pair of clippers. Wool had to be washed and sorted by hand. It had to be combed and cleaned by hand. It had to be dyed by hand, spun by hand, woven by hand, before you could even think about making it up into a garment. The raw materials were deeply expensive.
I was surprised to learn that there were actual laws about who got to wear what. And the purpose of those was literally so that walking down the street, people could sort of tell your station in life by looking at you.
Yeah, absolutely. You were what you wore. I mean, even now, clothes carry social clues, don't they, about people's wealth and people's cultural affiliations. It was just even more so. In a world in which all textiles were super expensive, it just made them that much more visible and therefore much more prone to the sort of tensions of personal display than they are in modern life. So yes, there were rules. They were particularly aimed at the top end of society who might have the options for choice. So there were certain colours and certain cloths that were reserved only for the king and his immediate blood family. And then every rank coming down as you emanate away from the king would have a slightly different set of things that they were allowed to wear that nobody else was. I mean, to this day, if you were to see footage of the House of Lords, which is the upper chamber in the British system, not the normal chamber, which is MPs who are elected, but the peers, the lords, the robes that they wear on ceremonial occasions, they're all sort of red. But if you look, the details on them, the amount of white fur on them particularly, is very varied. And it all says exactly which rank they are. Is it a duke? Is it an earl? Is it a baronet? You can tell by the clothes.
And the expression wearing many hats within a company or an organization would have made perfect sense to the Tudors.
It would, yeah. Hats were particularly invested with meaning. And that extended right down the social scale. So the sort of hat you might see an apprentice in wouldn't be the same sort of hat you would see his master wearing. And certain hats had certain sort of professional meaning. So barber surgeons and physicians particularly seem to have worn a very particular little velvet black cap underneath a further hat on top. And one of those actually survives. When the Mary Rose, which was Henry VIII's flagship, sank, everything went to the bottom, including the chest belonging to the barber surgeon on board. And within that chest, preserved in the muds at the bottom of the sea, is his velvet cap.
You developed a real fondness for ruffs. And I have to tell you, I love the way they look, but they've always seemed just stunningly uncomfortable to me.
Yeah, they can be a bit awkward to wear. You do have to change your movements when you're wearing them. Not as much, perhaps, sometimes as you see in films, because generally, when you're seeing an image on screen, what you're seeing is whatever their budgets can afford. So, you know, even the biggest budget film has some limitations, and they tend to sort of, you know, ruffs are often something that they tend to sort of, you know, skimp is the wrong word, but they, you know, they're finding an economical way of doing it, which involves a lot of glue often and modern materials. Real ruffs made by hand out of linen and set in starch are not as uncomfortable as the sort of plastic play ruffs that you see on film. And naturally, that's going to affect how you move in it. So actors and actresses are often struggling with something that is, you know, really not very historical. You know, it's making them move in odd ways and being really uncomfortable. The real ones are reasonable to wear, but you do have to learn how to wear them. Just like learning how to wear high heels. You know, you have to change your behaviour so that it fits. And what you really find is that you tend to pivot from your feet rather than trying to turn your head.
Well, that's interesting because if you look at like Tudor era paintings, portraits, people sometimes their posture seems different than ours. And I've wondered if that's just idealized or if that's a factor of what the clothes caused them to do.
I think it's quite largely about the clothes. Having made and worn as accurate as I possibly can replicas for many years, a lot of those postures are dictated by clothing. They're also dictated by the nature of the furniture, which is also partly dictated by the clothing. And they are, at the same time, those postures are culturally learned and culturally influenced. So what is considered to be beautiful? What is considered to be elegant? How do you wish to be portrayed is part of the reason for those very distinctive postures. And the other thing to say that I find very interesting is that movement and posture is not natural for any of us. It is all, for all of us, culturally learned. So if you're interested in movement, if you're the sort of person, I don't know, you study dance or maybe a lot of actors are very interested in it as well. If you watch people, if you just sit in a cafe and do a bit of people watching, you can tell somebody's nationality by how they move down the street, how they sit in a chair. And you can tell cultural groups within a nationality from the way people move. It is a learned behaviour.
Tell us, Ruth, about some of the kinds of things that you cannot fully understand about a particular time in history unless you've tried them for yourself. You've had a lot of experience with this now.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, you say can't fully. Maybe you can with a leap of imagination. I think it just helps to do it. I think it makes you ask different questions, think about things in different ways. I've always felt very strongly that recreating the past is never going to give you absolute answers. What it does is informs your questioning of the original sources. So, you know, I find myself questioning all sorts of things. I mean, one of the things, you mentioned smell right up there at the front, and you said, you know, maybe they didn't say smell so bad. That's been a feeling of mine for a while. Everybody tells you that, oh, they stank. They didn't wash, they stank. And the evidence says, no, they didn't really do very much in the way of water washing. It was really quite unusual to water wash the body. So you think, well, they must have stunk then, surely. And then as I start being more interested in laundry and methods of cleaning, you know, you start saying, I don't know, this doesn't really make sense, this idea of everybody stinking. Here's all these lovely clean clothes, you're putting them on, blah, blah, blah. So I just tried it. So I just, you know, so first of all, I did an experiment in modern life, and I didn't want anybody to know. So I got myself, well, who would? So I got myself an Elizabethan smock, a very fine one, and I just wore that underneath perfectly ordinary modern clothes.
When you say smock, it's like a slip or a
like
chemise.
Like a nightshirt. You know, sort of comes down to your ankles, your wrists, covers the whole of you. Mm-hmm. And it's made of a linen, not cotton, linen. And I chose quite a fine one. So obviously wearing that, I couldn't really wear jeans because you can't wear it. But if you wore a sort of, you know, 3/4 length skirt, nobody would need to know that I had this on underneath, that was my underwear. And what I did was not wash myself at all for 3 months, but I changed that underwear every day. And nobody noticed. Or at least they didn't notice enough to say anything, which might not be exactly the same thing perhaps, but... But I certainly wasn't, you know, nobody was pulling away from me. Nobody was, you know, like if you meet a tramp, oh, hang on, that's not the right word, is it, for America?
People who live homeless.
You know, the smell is quite strong often and hits you from quite a distance. And people do have a very visible physical response to that. And I wasn't getting that response. So that was interesting. And then I got an opportunity to film, you mentioned it, Tudor Monastery Farm. And that was a 6-month period. So again, I didn't actually tell my colleagues because I didn't want to prejudice their responses. And this time I was being working class, so I wore something that was much, much heavier weight linen, something that was really quite chunky. And I washed it once a week.
And it was fine.
No, again, they didn't notice. I mean, I did smell during that, but what I smelt of was wood smoke. Because we were outdoors most of the time. The spaces we were using were full of smoke when we were indoors because of hearths in the centre, on the fire, you know, on the floor in the centre of the room. That's what I smelt of. I smelt of smoke.
Ruth Goodman is my guest. She's a historian of British social and domestic life and host of the BBC series Tudor Monastery Farm. She was also historical advisor to the miniseries Wolf Hall. We're talking today about her new book, How to Be a Tudor, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Tudor Life. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Thank On KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with a historical advisor to the miniseries Wolf Hall and host of the BBC series Tudor Monastery Farm, Ruth Goodman. She has a new book out called How to Be a Tudor, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Tudor Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Ruth, I want to go back to something that you said earlier. You dropped this phrase, barber surgeon. Now, I like my hairdresser and I like my doctor, but I'm very glad they're not the same woman.
Well, they used to be. when I say it, it wouldn't have been woman either. It would have been man. They did both jobs because you needed really, really sharp knives. And that's what it came down to. Skill with a blade.
And so what sort of things would you go to the barber to have done? Dental work?
Well, obviously, to have your beard shaved, quite clearly, have your hair cut, but also to have bloodlet. Most understanding of the human body at that period was based on the four humours, that a person was made of blood, phlegm, yellow bile and black bile in some combination or other. And that if this balance within your body became disturbed for some reason, you would become sick. And to restore this balance, one of the things you could do was to take away excess blood. Anything that gave you a temperature, gave you a fever, was diagnosed as being from having too much blood in the wrong places or in the wrong sort of, you know, areas of your blood. Or anyway, too much blood. So you would need to have it removed. And barber surgeons were the people to go to for that service. And they could take it in a number of ways. They could just cut you with a blade in certain places and let you bleed from it. They could apply heated cupping so that the blood is drawn through the pores of the skin. Or you often scarify the skin first, so you've got lots of little tiny cuts, and then the cup goes on the top. Or leeches, the very famous leeches, to take the blood from particular parts of the body, all of which were considered to have particular effects medically.
Wow.
Don't get a fever if you get back in time.
This is something I gather you didn't try when you were living as a tutor.
I haven't had bloodletting taken for medical purposes. I have tried myself privately without. I have tried cupping. That hurts. Uh-huh. And I have had a leech on me. Yeah, that doesn't hurt.
Huh. All right. You know, a lot of times when we see movies about people in the Tudor period, if they are not royals, they have just horrific teeth. Yeah. Was this true?
Well, I think the evidence, the archaeological evidence, is that teeth were much the same then as they are now. The incidence of caries was quite similar. People in Elizabethan Britain were not eating very much sugar, of course, and many dentists tell us that it's our sugar habits that cause such bad teeth. But the real problem with sugar is that it creates acid in the mouth, and it's the acid that is often doing the damage. There are many other ways of ending up with acid in your mouth. A lot of pickled food will do it, a lot of preserved food. So people had bad teeth at every level of society, same as they do now, really. And the difference is that we have ways of putting that right, and they didn't.
I remember as a kid being told that, the spice trade took off because people had no refrigeration and had to eat a lot of spoiled meat.
No, you were told that one as well, were you?
And I remember thinking, I was probably in fourth grade, and I remember thinking, like, dumping cinnamon on a bad steak doesn't sound like it would make a better meal.
You were really clever. You were right.
And it turns out it was just too expensive to use those precious
Absolutely.
Spices.
Absolutely. It's utter, utter bunkum. The idea seems to have originally come as a sort of racial prejudice slur against people from the Asia sort of regions of the world, particularly India. People said, there was an awful lot of, they eat those curries, but they have to eat those curries because their food is so awful. You've got to disguise the flavour. Sneer, sneer, sneer. And then about 1960s, 70s, you start finding those sneers about the British past. I'm not really quite sure how it transferred from being a racial slur to being a time slur, but it did. And it really took off as an idea and turns up everywhere. You can find it in in, you know, almost every literature written for about 30 years. It's beginning to go out of fashion again as an idea, I'm pleased to say. But I've read it in the preambles of truly good pieces of historical research, you know, in the sort of summing up, you know, setting the scene bit before they then go off into their own specialism. Yeah, it's been very current as an idea. And of course, it makes absolutely no sense. I mean, before we were human beings, we could tell the difference between rotten meat and non-rotten meat. Well, lizards can tell the difference between fresh meat and rotten meat. It's a really obvious smell and you know, you can't hide it. And the other thing, of course, as you pointed out, is that the spices were way more expensive than the meat. I mean, you know, it cost you sixpence to put some spice on a piece of meat that cost you twopence. Hmm. You'd get a new bit of meat, wouldn't you? so it doesn't work. Costs a fortune. It just never happened.
How often did people get meat?
Very much a matter of where you were on the social scale. Mm-hmm. People wanted meat. It was it was considered the best sort of food, the most healthy sort of food. Pork in particular was considered to be the closest thing to the human body, and therefore that you would gain most nutrition from that than anything else. But large swathes of the population basically had to manage without. Were living on bread and a variety of vegetables made into stews. Meat for many people was a special treat. Mm.
So I understand completely that the water wasn't purified, could, you know, demonstrably make people sick, and so they looked to fermented beverages. How was it that people didn't walk around drunk all the time?
Because it was very weak, mm-hmm. very, very weak. When you were brewing, you made basically three batches off the same malt. So beer, it usually was ale, actually, rather than beer. Ale is barley that's been allowed to sprout. You stop the sprout at the moment when the grain has transformed all the starch into sugar. That's what malt is. You pour water on this malt and all the sugars move into the water. So you've now got a sort of sweet liquid. You add some yeast and it ferments. That makes a sort of fairly strongish batch, depending on how much water you put in. If you then take that malt, once the first lot of water has been drained off, and put a second lot of water on it, the second brew is going to be weaker, and the third brew weaker still. And then people could sort of slightly blend. And basically what you made was something that you could drink all day, every day, without being drunk. You only made strong beer in small quantities now and again for partying. Most of it, you know, you could drink your eight pints a day and not notice.
Okay, so these days in the United States, you know, sometimes the car you drive communicates your status to other people. Mm. It's the possession that you have that will show people that you have a lot of money or not so much money. For the Tudors, it was all about the bed.
It could be, yeah. It could well be. As a sort of domestic thing, I mean, clothes did that thing for you out and about. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, how many people see your bed? Right. But lots of people see your clothes. But within the house, the bed was the piece of furniture. It was the white good of its day. It was the most expensive single thing that you might own within your home. And part of that is because it was covered in textiles. We're back again to cloth, the expensiveness of cloth. So a good bed that had four posts about it, that had a wooden frame to raise you up off the floor, that had all the layers of mattresses and sheets and blankets, and that had curtains all the way around and a cover over the top so that you were inside a little warm textile cave. That was a very expensive thing. It was a very comfortable thing. So it's also becomes part of the culture of display, as you so rightly point out. So bedrooms were not, I say bedrooms were indoors, obviously, but they weren't as private as a modern bedroom is. A bedroom was often your receiving room. Hmm. So it's sort of like, it's almost like a bed sitter, but that makes it sound sort of cheap, and it wasn't used like that. It was a sort of, there was the public space, the hall, where you might do business and people came and went, and there was a clanking of boots and coats and what have you, and that was the sort of big public space of the house. And then if you wanted to have a private conversation and talk to your friends, you would invite them into your chamber, and within your chamber would be your bed. And you would sit on stools, you would chat and you would eat, and, you know, more like a teenager's bedroom, really. It's a social space as well as a sleeping space. So the more beautiful your bed looked, the more you're going to impress your friends. You can't impress the average man out on the street with your bed, but you sure can impress your friends.
So if you didn't have a budget, Ruth, for a beautiful bed, if you lived in more modest circumstances, you might be sleeping on ropes, on straw. Tell us about some of the configurations that people use.
Well, it's quite varied, and it does change over time. I mean, Tudor period is quite long. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of the Tudor era, a lot of people were still sleeping just plainly on the floor. But that doesn't mean on wooden boards or on, you know, stone or anything. What it usually means is on a bed of rushes, strewn rushes. So you've got a sort of like insulating layer across the floor, which is reasonably comfortable to sleep on, actually. Hmm. I haven't done, you know, long periods of time. I've certainly had a couple of naps on such a floor. and you need very little then to be reasonably comfortable. You're on this sort of, as I say, almost like a sort of, like a very thick carpet or a thin mattress, that sort of thing on the floor. And then just need a couple of blankets over the top of you. It can roll up very easily during the day because you don't touch the floor, do you? You just roll the blankets up and put them in a chest. And certainly in the great households, when you think of all those servants in a Tudor household, there weren't any secret attic bedrooms anywhere. Most of those servants were actually sleeping on the floor in the hall on top of the rushes with just a blanket. That was quite common and quite common for large sections of the population out and about in their little village homes. Raised up off the floor, you get little wooden bedsteads, and they become more necessary when you start having a chimney in your house, because once you've got a chimney, you've got a draft at floor level.
Huh.
So you want to come up, you know, you don't want to be on the floor anymore. It's horrible down there now. And that great move from a fire in the middle of your room to a fire in a chimney place, this was a vast, it was a revolution in the way we lived. And it's a revolution that really happens during the Tudor period, with most people living with a central fire, sleeping on the floor at the beginning of that period, when Henry VII is on the throne. And most people having a chimney and a wooden bedstead by the end of that era, Elizabeth. And that seems like a very much more modern pattern to us. They both work. You know, I mean, they're both okay. So, you know, and it varied enormously. I mean, there were still people by the end who were, you know, of Elizabeth's reign, who were sleeping on the floor, but by then they'd become a minority, and most people had some sort of raised up wooden platform. And what went on that wooden platform also would vary. If you didn't have a lot of resources, then you'd just have a bed full of straw. And a bed was the old word for what we would now call a mattress, like, so it was just like a big sack. So a sack full of straw, that would be your straw bed. If you had more resources than that, you would fill a bed with wool, and that's a flock bed. Well, naturally, you know, that's going to be reasonably comfy, isn't it? It works better if it's on top of another straw bed, so you have two.
Like mattress and box spring almost.
Well, yeah, exactly. And then if you have more resources still, you have a third one on top, which is full of feathers, a feather bed.
So now
Go on.
I was going to say, now we can start to think about, you know, the old fairy tale, The Princess and the Pea. All those mattresses were a thing.
Exactly. They were. And I mean, the very richest didn't just have one feather mattress. They'd have different grades of feather. Hmm. So, you know, you would, you know, four mattresses on the bed would be, you know, the sort of thing you would be expecting in Duke so-and-so's household.
And when we say sleep tight, I always assumed that was about being tucked in nice and cozy, but that has nothing to do with it.
Well, it's probably to do with the ropes. So if you think of the wooden frame that we start talking about, if you have a wooden base to that, it's very hard to sleep on. You can put your straw bed on top of it, and some of the beds were like that. But a sort of sophisticated version was, instead of putting a solid wooden base to your bed, you would actually string ropes across in a sort of crisscross fashion, and they're pulled very tight. They're quite bouncy. It's almost like being on a sort of slightly trampoline-y sort of surface, and that's got much more give and is much more comfortable to have your mattresses on top of. But if the ropes slacken, you all end up, you know, with a sort of dip in the middle, and you all fall in the middle, and that's nothing like as pleasant. So most people think that the terminology sleep tight refers to keeping these ropes very tight so that you've got a nice springy base to your bed.
All right, let's clear something up. Many people have heard that Shakespeare left his wife Anne Hathaway his second best bed and assumed they must have been on very poor terms when he died.
And that's not necessarily so. I mean, you would expect the usual pattern of inheritance would be for the best bet to go to his daughter. I mean, he had at that time an adult married daughter. And you would expect that to go to her and the widow to get the next one. And that's a fairly normal sort of pattern within that period. It varies very slightly. Sometimes, you know, the best bed would stay with the widow, sometimes not. But it wouldn't. I know what you mean. I think many people have interpreted it as a slur, and I'm just not convinced. He's left her a very good bed. When you look at how much it's worth in that sort of context, he had quite a lot of property by the end of his life, and a bed of that standard was of the best sort.
And if people didn't go to the theater to see something Shakespeare had done, they might find themselves a nice bear-baiting match to keep them busy. Sounds
true.
So awful.
It does, doesn't it? I know, and the details make it sound even worse. I mean, there's a bit of me that thinks that, in comparison, you know, the sort of Spanish running around in a ring sounds positively kind. Hmm. So, I mean, British bear-baiting and bull-baiting, they did both, consisted of tying the animal to a stake set in the ground so that it had sort of 6 feet of rope between it and the stake so it couldn't move very far, and then setting a pack of dogs on it. Pretty grim, frankly. And they were big dogs, big mastiffs. Archaeologically, around that area of London, a lot of the skulls have been found off mastiffs. They are big dogs. But interestingly, very few bear skulls, because bears were an expensive beast. So ideally, you wanted to make sure your bear survived to fight another day. The dogs were cheaper. So the fights were sort of fixed, if you like. It was sort of weighted in favour of the bear, despite the fact that it's on a chain, staked to the ground, the number of dogs you sent against it, etc. And animals that returned to the ring again and again often ended up with a following. They became famous in their own right. And, of course, betting would therefore sort of, you know, change according to that. And the bears would also sort of, as part of the show, be sort of like walked around the public. So they'd sort of be taken on a tour and, you know, which people found very exciting, you know. A live scary bear on the end of a string.
I can see them being exciting even today.
And some bears, they would sort of like torment in other ways to make them do something interesting. One poor blind bear used to be beaten with a stick, and they used to think it was terribly funny the way it lashed out, not knowing where the stick was.
Mm. Ruth Goodman is my guest. She's a historian of British social and domestic life who hosted the BBC series Tudor Monastery Farm and was historical advisor to Wolf Hall. Her new book is called How to Be a Tudor, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Tudor Life. Welcome back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
Sleeves there to welcome back my guest, Ruth Goodman. She's a historian who advised the miniseries Wolf Hall and has a new book out called How to Be a Tudor, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Tudor Life. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Okay, Ruth, Greensleeves is not like a disco hit, but the Tudors did like to dance, and they didn't dance in that very staid way, exclusively in that very staid way that we imagine.
No. I think a lot of us have this sort of impression of historical dancers being really quite stuffy.
Sort of holding up one hand and moving around.
Yeah, wandering around. And that's usually because we get our impressions from film and television, and they have very short rehearsal times. And you know, there's no guarantee that actors are any, you know, have any dance experience. So they keep it simple. And the evidence suggests that that is not true of the actual Tudors. Dancing was certainly central at court. We have plenty of evidence in the form of letters to ambassadors and things talking about the virtuosity of Henry VIII and indeed of Elizabeth. Both are recorded as being superbly skilled and very vigorous dancers. And we have lots and lots of information too about how popular dancing was amongst the young out in the country in general, about how often it was going on, about how enthusiastic people were about it. And that you know, it just gives a completely different picture. And many of the dance fragments of dances and information of dances that we have come down to us, well, they are quite fragmentary and one can interpret them in a number of ways. Some people choose to interpret them in a very, very, very heavy, slow way. Me, I don't. I think they was bouncy and fun. I don't think that the moralists at the end of the period, at the late Elizabethan, you start getting, just beginning to get those sort of hotter sort of Protestants really starting to shout and say dancing is evil and wicked, and you're beginning to get those sorts of voices. And they wouldn't have, surely, if it had all been very sedate. I mean, what they're saying about it is, it's disgusting, all this kissing and touching and, and jumping up and down. All it's really, you know, that doesn't sound to me like something staid. And
it's Tudor mosh pit is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So when you're advising any kind of historical production, and I know that you've done this work for a long time, like, are there things that you think I've got to put my foot down here? You know, how often do you really have to raise a red flag and how often are you just there to sort of, you know, approve of what's already been done?
Yeah, well, it varies enormously. Sometimes you just want to tear your hair out.
Yeah.
And you know you're going nowhere. You know that they're really not listening, that they're paying you lip service, and the instant your back is turned, it's all going to go. And other times people try really hard, really hard. And sometimes you've just blown away by how beautiful, you know, how right they get it. And that's lovely. It does vary enormously. It varies, obviously, on things like budget and timings and, you know, I mean, everybody has constraints within their work. But it also depends on people involved. You know, some people are more interested than others. For some people, you know, history is something they have to sort of pay a nod to because they've been told they have to. And they emotionally just don't want to engage with that. And, you know, you can imagine the results that happen. And other people, you know, just fall in love with it and really go the extra mile. It's very varied.
I'm not an expert in history, but sometimes I judge just based on how accurately women's hair and even cosmetics are followed. Because sometimes, you know, you look at films from the 60s and everybody's got a big bouffant hairdo and false eyelashes and you just know those didn't exist 400 years ago.
Well, I'm sort of with you a bit there. The willingness of an actor to wear a hat is a big thing. I have... Hats were absolutely de rigueur for men in the Elizabethan and the, you know, right throughout the Tudor period. They were the thing. You had your head covered unless you were taking it off to show respect. That's why you take it off in church, to show respect to God. It was a completely utter hat wearing society, and there was an enormous amount of etiquette and meaning conveyed by your hat. It didn't just say what status you were, but how you wore it said things about you. How you took it off to show respect to somebody was a way of communicating how much respect you really had for them. You know, you could express an awful lot about your personality through the way you used your hat. Now, a lot of actors get that and use them beautifully. And you learn to, you know, you learn to make it a very expressive thing that I think adds an extra dimension to their performance. And every now and again, you get one who just won't, just will not wear a hat. No, 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 that's not my image. That's not what I'm known for. I don't wear hats.
Yeah, so is it like, have you seen this glorious head of hair? I'm not going to leave this covered up.
Yeah, one does get that sometimes. And I think it's a real shame because I think all that sort of like fiddle and movement and doing, you know, I think it's a gift to acting. I think it allows you another means of communicating, but you know, not everybody shares my opinions.
Life was pretty precarious in the Tudor era. I mean, medicine wasn't what it is today. A lot of people were walking around malnourished. You could die pretty quickly, and maybe not entirely consequently, but people were careful about praying.
Yes, I mean, religion was utterly central to life. You know, there just was no other way of understanding the world. There were no other options. You know, whatever everybody told you was the only way to understand the world from the moment you were born. It was absolutely central to life, and it got reinforced at every stage, at every moment, from every direction. It was an all-encompassing experience.
Did they recite prayers, or did they have the sort of free-form chatting with God that people do today?
Well, again, that varied enormously. And again, this huge, long period of history with this sort of earthquake, shattering change right in the middle,
right,
when the traditional forms of worship were suddenly turned upside down, ripped apart, rebuilt. That was ripped apart and rebuilt again, and then off we go again. And of course, I'm talking about the Reformation, that move from Britain as a Catholic country to Britain as a Protestant country. But it wasn't a simple, clean once break. It happened, you know, first we were supposedly Catholic. Then Henry breaks with the Church of Rome and we become sort of something slightly different. Then his son comes along and a whole new hot sort of Protestantism rises, and then that's thrown out and we leap back to Catholicism, and then that disappears and a different sort of Protestantism comes in, which gradually mutates and changes about five times during Elizabeth's reign. It's enormous change going on. Everybody's life reflected that, and habits, even very personal private habits, were influenced and changed. And there are elements of continuity. The central tenets of Christianity were still there. But there was a vast amount of change too. So if you were to take a very ordinary person during Henry VII's reign, before all this challenge arises, then there were very traditional forms of personal prayer that somebody who wasn't even particularly devout, you know, just very, very ordinary, just, you know, going through the motions of day, had this set of prayers that you said at particular times. There were a set of gestures you did at particular times in particular places. It was all very sort of set. You would learn them by rote, or if you could read, you could read them out from a written text as written. You would have a personal relationship with God. There was a lot of mysticism about, but the normal performance of religion was very much about following what was written, following rote. And then one of the main tensions within the church was, and within religion, I should say, rather than the church, was the idea of a personal relationship with God, a more chatty, personal style, something that was not set in stone, something that was more free form. And that comes into people's worship. But what I find interesting is that much of this sort of free-form worship that you find within people who would call themselves Protestants at the end of the Tudor period still uses an awful lot of rote learning and still uses an awful lot of form. You know, it's sort of like freestyle, but not quite. So I'm particularly, there's a little book of prayers written by a woman, Anne Wheathill, in the late Elizabethan, that I'm particularly fond of. It's unusual only because it's written by a woman rather than written by a man. It's absolutely conventional Elizabethan Protestantism. And what she's written is a series of prayers to be read and said. Her writing of them is very free form, but you're not supposed to free form off them. You're supposed to just read them. And you know, so there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of sort of places in which you as an individual could make a stand and say, I want to do it this way, I want to do that. This is the way I feel is right. This is, you know, I've listened to what everybody said. This is my interpretation. There was a lot of room for variation and difference within a very structured framework.
Let's go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Maggie on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. Another great topic, as usual.
Thank you.
Quite a few years ago, a woman from, I think, the BBC named Lucy Skipping, I think is how she says her name, did a talk about music and broadsides from the period I think you're discussing. And I'm wondering how much of what you have come up with as far as this history and information comes from the work of intermediate scholars after the period, or are you going to broadsides and publications? How do you glean this information?
Hi, thank you. Yes, I like to go straight to the source, just like Lucy Skipping does. I like Lucy Skipping's work. I've read it. Very good. Very interesting. But yeah, like her, I like to read the original stuff.
And we also had a question from someone who absolutely loved Wolf Hall, this via email. And the question, let me see if I can pull it back up. Was there anything while doing the show that you simply had to guess on or were unaware of its origins? This is from Joey in Denton.
Yeah, there always is. You know, I mean, it's a long time ago and not everything comes down to us. So there are moments, particularly when you're trying to do something concrete. You know, if you're writing a book, you can always, you know, I don't know that, but you can just keep quiet. And sort of like move across that bit.
Right.
But if you're trying to do something, you know, do something, you've somehow got to get over that gap. And that means that you do occasionally have to make leaps of imagination. You have to sort of guess. It sounds terrible. You make the best educated guess you possibly can. But there are things that you just don't know. Just don't know.
What was childhood like in the Tudor period?
Well, it could be quite short for some people.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people reckon about a third of all children who were born alive were dead by the time they were five, so it could be quite short. The early tiny bit, I mean, obviously you're swaddled as a teeny, teeny, teeny one. First 6 weeks, full swaddling, arms in. And then at about 6 weeks, babies usually about that point start to want to wave their arms, and that's exactly the point that traditionally we used to let the arms out. So the arms come out of the swaddling and they're just swaddled then down. And then they stay swaddled until about 3 to 4 months, which again is about the point in which human development, babies like to start moving their legs a lot more than before. And that's the point that you take them out of that full swaddling. So the pattern of swaddling sort of followed human development as mm-hmm. we now know it. Once you came out of swaddling, you were into little skirts, both boys and girls, which of course makes it a lot easier for all the nappy potty malarkey.
Right.
Sometimes said that small children were, you know, just like mini adults. I don't really see that. Children were children. And you can sort of, this other lady said, how much do I use historians' work and how much do I use original? There are some historians whose work is just superb and mm-hmm. one finds oneself blown away by their scholarship. There's one lady who did a really good analysis of coroner's records, mostly in the late medieval period, when all the accidents that ever happened are recorded. And she sort of did an analysis. And what she saw was that people of different ages were having different accident patterns. And obviously the two sexes were having different accident patterns. And that really interestingly, those accident patterns, again, do follow normal human development. Children are having different accidents from adults. Small children are having different accidents from sort of the mid-range of childhood. And they're having different accidents from young teenagers. So there clearly is a development in the experience of life, just like there is now. Yes, youngsters were given jobs to do. From very young, people were, children were expected to help out around and about the place. Particularly that meant for sort of 6 and 7 year olds, an awful lot of minding babies and fetching water, fetching and carrying, that sort of thing. And gradually it develops. But, you know, lads at 17 are still falling out of trees and getting themselves hurt. So, you've got a picture of, think of a society in which all help is necessary. You know, yeah. You need everybody's work. But you're still human.
Ruth Goodman's new book is called How to Be a Tutor, A Dawn to Dusk Guide to Tutor Life. Ruth, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.